The situation is made still worse by reason of the fact that the leaders of those parties which were responsible for the national betrayal are ready to oppose any and every attempt at a revival, simply because they want to retain the positions they now hold. According to the laws that govern human history, it is inconceivable that the German people could resume the place they formerly held without retaliating on those who were both cause and occasion of the collapse that involved the ruin of our state. Before the judgment seat of posterity, November 1918 will not be regarded as a simple rebellion, but as high treason against the country. Therefore, it is not possible to think of re-establishing German sovereignty and political independence without at the same time reconstructing a united front within the nation by a peaceful conversion of the popular will. Looked at from the standpoint of practical ways and means, it seems absurd to think of liberating Germany from foreign bondage as long as the masses of the people are not willing to support such an ideal of freedom. After carefully considering this problem from the purely military point of view, everybody, and in particular every officer, will agree that a war cannot be waged against an outside enemy by battalions of students, but that, together with the brains of the nation, the physical strength of the nation is also necessary. Furthermore, it must be remembered that the nation would be robbed of its irreplaceable assets by a national defence in which only the intellectual circles, as they are called, were engaged. The young German intellectuals who joined the volunteer regiments and fell on the battlefields of Flanders in the autumn of 1914 were bitterly missed later on. They were the dearest treasure which the nation possessed, and their loss could not be made good in the course of the war. And it is not only the struggle itself which could not be waged if the working masses of the nation did not join the storm battalions, but the necessary technical preparations could not be made without a unified will and a common front within the nation itself. Our nation, which has to exist disarmed under the thousand eyes appointed by the Versailles Peace Treaty, cannot make any technical preparations for the recovery of its freedom and human independence until the whole army of spies employed within the country is cut down to those few whose inborn baseness would lead them to betray anything and everything for the proverbial 30 pieces of silver. But we can deal with such people. The millions, however, who are opposed to every kind of national revival simply because of their political opinions constitute an insurmountable obstacle. At least the obstacle will remain insurmountable as long as the cause of their opposition, which is international Marxism, is not overcome and its teachings banished from both their hearts and heads. From whatever point of view we may examine the possibility of recovering our independence as a state and a people, whether we consider the problem from the standpoint of technical rearmament or from that of the actual struggle itself, the necessary prerequisite always remains the same. This prerequisite is that the broad masses of the people must first be won over to accept the principle of our national independence. If we do not regain our external freedom, every step forward in domestic reform will at best be an augmentation of our productive powers for the benefit of those nations that look upon us as a colony to be exploited. The surplus produced by any so-called improvement would only go into the hands of our international controllers, and any social betterment would at best increase the product of our labour in favour of those people. No cultural progress can be made by the German nation, because such progress is too much bound up with the political independence and dignity of a people. Therefore, as we can find a satisfactory solution for the problem of Germany's future only by winning over the broad masses of our people for the support of the national idea, this work of education must be considered the highest and most important task to be accomplished by a movement which does not strive merely to satisfy the needs of the moment, but considers itself bound to examine in the light of future results everything it decides to do or refrain from doing. As early as 1919, we were convinced that the nationalization of the masses would have to constitute the first and paramount aim of the new movement. From the tactical standpoint, this decision laid a certain number of obligations on our shoulders. 1. No social sacrifice could be considered too great in this effort to win over the masses for the national revival. In the field of national economics, whatever concessions are granted today to the employees are negligible when compared with the benefit to be reaped by the whole nation if such concessions contribute to bring back the masses of the people once more to the bosom of their own nation. Nothing but meanness and short-sightedness, which are characteristics that unfortunately are only too prevalent among our employers, could prevent people from recognizing that in the long run, no economic improvement, and therefore no rise in profits, are possible unless internal solidarity be restored among the bulk of the people who make up our nation. If the German trades unions had defended the interests of the working classes uncompromisingly during the war, if, even during the war, they had used the weapon of the strike to force the industrialists, who were greedy for higher dividends, to grant the demands of the workers for whom the unions acted, if, at the same time, they had stood up as good Germans for the defence of the nation as stoutly as for their own claims, and if they had given to their country what was their country's due, then the war would never have been lost. How ludicrously insignificant would all, and even the greatest economic concession have been in face of the tremendous importance of such a victory. For a movement which would restore the German worker to the German people, it is therefore absolutely necessary to understand clearly that economic sacrifices must be considered light in such cases, provided, of course, that they do not go to the length of endangering the independence and stability of the national economic system. 2. The education of the masses along national lines can be carried out only indirectly by improving their social conditions. For only by such a process can the economic conditions be created which enable everybody to share in the cultural life of the nation. 3. The nationalization of the broad masses can never be achieved by half measures. That is to say, by feebly insisting on what is called the objective side of the question, but only by a ruthless and devoted insistence on the one aim which must be achieved. This means that a people cannot be made national according to the signification attached to that word by our bourgeois class today. That is to say, nationalism with many reservations, but national in the vehement and extreme sense. Poison can be overcome only by a counter-poison, and only the supine bourgeois mind could think that the kingdom of heaven can be attained by a compromise. The broad masses of a nation are not made up of professors and diplomats. Since these masses have only a poor acquaintance with abstract ideas, their reactions lie more in the domain of the feelings, where the roots of their positive as well as their negative attitudes are implanted. They are susceptible only to a manifestation of strength which comes definitely either from the positive or negative side. But they are never susceptible to any half-hearted attitude that wavers between one pole and the other. The emotional grounds of their attitude furnish the reason for their extraordinary stability. It is always more difficult to fight successfully against faith than against knowledge. Love is less subject to change than respect. Hatred is more lasting than mere aversion. And the driving force which has brought about the most tremendous revolutions on this earth has never been a body of scientific teaching which has gained power over the masses, but always a devotion which has inspired them, and often a kind of hysteria which has urged them to action. Whoever wishes to win over the masses must know the key that will open the door to their hearts. It is not objectivity, which is a feckless attitude, but a determined will backed up by force when necessary. 4. The soul of the masses can be won only if those who lead the movement for that purpose are determined not merely to carry through the positive struggle for their own aims, but are also determined to destroy the enemy that opposes them. When they see an uncompromising onslaught against an adversary, the people have at all times taken this as proof that right is on the side of the active aggressor. But if the aggressor should only go halfway and fail to push home his success by driving his opponent entirely from the scene of action, the people will look upon this as a sign that the aggressor is uncertain of the justice of his own cause, and his halfway policy may even be an acknowledgement that his cause is unjust. The masses are but a part of nature herself. Their feeling is such that they cannot understand mutual handshakings between men who are declared enemies. Their wish is to see the stronger side win, and the weaker wiped out, or subjected unconditionally to the will of the stronger. The nationalization of the masses can be successfully achieved only if, in the positive struggle to win the soul of the people, those who spread the international poison among them are exterminated.